This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present All the Birds in the Sky by Charlie Jane Anders. Narrated by Elisa Bresnahan. A quote by George Dyson from Darwin Among the Machines. In the game of life and evolution, there are three players at the table: human beings, nature, and machines. I am firmly on the side of nature, but nature, I suspect, is on the side of the machines. Book 1. Chapter 1. When Patricia was 6 years old, she found a wounded bird. The sparrow thrashed on top of a pile of wet red leaves in the crook of two roots, waving its crushed wing. Crying, in a pitch almost too high for Patricia to hear, she looked into the sparrow's eye, enveloped by a dark stripe, and she saw its fear. Not just fear, but also misery, as if this bird knew it would die soon. Patricia still didn't understand how the life could just go out of someone's body forever, but she could tell this bird was fighting against death with everything it had. Patricia vowed with all her heart to do everything in her power to save this bird. This was what led to Patricia being asked a question with no good answer, which marked her for life. She scooped up the sparrow with a dry leaf, very gently, and laid it in her red bucket. Rays of the afternoon sun came at the bucket horizontally, bathing the bird in red light, so it looked radioactive. The bird was still whipping around, trying to fly with one wing. "It's okay," Patricia told the bird. "I've got you. It's okay." Patricia had seen creatures in distress before. Her big sister, Roberta, liked to collect wild animals and play with them. Roberta put frogs into a rusty Cuisinart that her mom had tossed out, and stuck mice into her homemade rocket launcher to see how far she could shoot them. But this was the first time Patricia looked at a living creature in pain and really saw it. And every time she looked into the bird's eye, she swore harder that this bird was under her protection. "What's going on?" asked Roberta, smashing through the branches nearby. Both girls were pale, with dark brown hair that grew super straight no matter what you did, and nearly button noses. But Patricia was a wild, grubby girl, with a round face, green eyes, and perpetual grass stains on her torn overalls. She was already turning into the girl the other girls wouldn't sit with, because she was too hyper, made nonsense jokes, and wept when anybody's balloon, not just her own, got popped. Roberta, meanwhile, had brown eyes, a pointy chin, and absolutely perfect posture when she sat without fidgeting in a grown-up chair and a clean white dress. With both girls, their parents had hoped for a boy and picked out a name in advance. Upon each daughter's arrival, they'd just stuck an A on the end of the name they already had. "I found a wounded bird," Patricia said. "It can't fly. Its wing is ruined."
"I bet I can make it fly," Roberta said, and Patricia knew she was talking about her rocket launcher. "Bring it here. I'll make it fly real good."
"No!" Patricia's eyes flooded, and she felt short of breath. "You can't! You can't!" And then she was running, careening, with the red bucket in one hand. She could hear her sister behind her, smashing branches. She ran faster, back to the house. Their house had been a spice shop 100 years ago, and it still smelled of cinnamon and turmeric and saffron and garlic and a little sweat. The perfect hardwood floors had been walked on by visitors from India and China and everywhere, bringing everything spicy in the world. If Patricia closed her eyes and breathed deeply, she could imagine the people unloading wooden foil-lined crates stamped with names of cities like Marrakesh and Bombay. Her parents had read a magazine article about renovating colonial trade houses and had snapped up this building, and now they were constantly yelling at Patricia not to run indoors or scratch any of the perfect oak furnishings until their foreheads showed veins.
Patricia's parents were the sort of people who could be in a good mood and angry at almost the same time. Patricia paused in a small clearing of maples near the back door. "It's okay," she told the bird. "I'll take you home. There's an old bird cage in the attic. I know where to find it. It's a nice cage. It has a perch and a swing. I'll put you in there. I'll tell my parents. If anything happens to you, I will hold my breath until I faint. I'll keep you safe. I promise."
"No," the bird said. "Please, don't lock me up. I would prefer you just kill me now."
"But," Patricia said, more startled that the bird was refusing her protection than that he was speaking to her.
"I can keep you safe. I can bring you bugs or seeds or whatever." "Captivity is worse than death for a bird like me," the sparrow said. "Listen, you can hear me talking, right? That means you're special, like a witch or something, and that means you have a duty to do the right thing. Please."
"Oh." This was all a lot for Patricia to take in. She sat down on a particularly large and grumpy tree root with thick bark that felt a little damp and sort of like sawtooth rocks. She could hear Roberta beating the bushes and the ground with a big Y-shaped stick over in the next clearing, and she worried about what would happen if Roberta heard them talking.
"But," Patricia said,
quieter so that Roberta wouldn't hear,
"but your wing is hurt, right? And I need to take care of you. You're stuck."
"Well," the bird seemed to think about this for a moment,
"you don't know how to heal a broken wing, do you?"
He flapped his bad wing. He'd looked just sort of gray-brown at first, but up close she could see brilliant red and yellow streaks along his wings, with a milk-white belly and a dark, slightly barbed beak.
"No, I don't know anything. I'm sorry." "Okay, so you could just put me up in a tree and hope for the best. But I'll probably get eaten or starve to death."
His head bobbed.
"Or, I mean, there is one thing."
"What?" Patricia looked at her knees, through the thready holes in her denim overalls, and thought her kneecaps looked like weird eggs.
"What?"
She looked over at the sparrow in the bucket, who was in turn studying her with one eye, as if trying to decide whether to trust her.
"Well," the bird chirped, "I mean, you could take me to the Parliament of Birds. They can fix a wing, no problem. And if you're going to be a witch, then you should meet them anyway. They're the smartest birds around. They always meet at the most majestic tree in the forest. Most of them are over 5 years old."
"I'm older than that," Patricia said. "I'm almost 7 in 4 months. Or 5. She heard Roberta getting closer, so she snatched up the bucket and took off running, deeper into the woods. The sparrow, whose name was Derp-a-Derp-a-Weep-along, or Derp for short, tried to give Patricia directions to the Parliament of Birds as best he could, but he couldn't see where he was going from inside the bucket, and his descriptions of the landmarks to watch for made no sense to Patricia. The whole thing reminded her of one of the cooperation exercises at school, which she was hopeless at ever since her only friend, Kathy, moved away. At last, Patricia perched Derp on her finger, like Snow White, and he bounced onto her shoulder. The sun went down. The forest was so thick, Patricia could barely see the stars or the moon, and she tumbled a few times, scraping her hands and her knees and getting dirt all over her new overalls. Derp clung to the shoulder strap of her overalls so hard his talons pinched her and almost broke her skin. He was less and less sure where they were going, although he was pretty sure the majestic tree was near some kind of stream, or maybe a field. He definitely thought it was a very thick tree, set apart from other trees, and if you looked the right way, the two big branches of the parliamentary tree fanned like wings. Also, he could tell the direction pretty easily by the position of the sun, if the sun had still been out. We're lost in the woods, Patricia said with a shiver. I'm probably going to be eaten by a bear.
I don't think there are bears in this forest, Derp said, and if one attacks us, you could try talking to it.
So I can talk to all animals now? Patricia could see this coming in useful, like if she could convince Mary Fenchurch's poodle to bite her the next time Mary was mean to Patricia, or if the next nanny her parents hired owned a pet.
I don't know, Derp said. Nobody ever explains anything to me.
Patricia decided there was nothing to do but climb the nearest tree and see if she could see anything from it, like a road or a house or some landmark that Derp might recognize. It was much colder on top of the big old oak that Patricia managed to jungle gym her way up. The wind soaked into her as if it were water instead of just air. Derp covered his face with his one good wing and had to be coaxed to look around.
Oh, okay, he quavered. Let me see if I can make sense of this landscape. This isn't really what you call a bird's eye view. A real bird's eye view would be much, much higher than this. This is a squirrel's eye view, at best.
Derp jumped off and scampered around the treetop until he spotted what he thought might be one of the signpost trees leading to the parliamentary tree.
We're not too far. He sounded perkier already. But we should hurry. They don't always meet all night, unless they're debating a tricky measure, or having question time. But you'd better hope it's not question time.
What's question time?
You don't want to know, Derp said.
Patricia was finding it much harder to get down from the treetop than it was to get up, which seemed unfair. She kept almost losing her grip, and the drop was nearly a dozen feet.
Hey, it's a bird, a voice said from the darkness, just as Patricia reached the ground. Come here, bird. I only want to bite you.
Oh, no, Derp said.
I promise I won't play with you too much, the voice said. It'll be fun. You'll see.
Who is that? Patricia said.
Tomington, Derp said. He's a cat. He lives in a house with people, but he comes into the forest and kills a lot of my friends. The Parliament is always debating what to do about him.
Oh, Patricia said. I'm not scared of a little kitty. Tomington jumped, pushing off a big log, and landed on Patricia's back, like a missile with fur and sharp claws. Patricia screeched and nearly fell on her face.
Get off me, she said. Give me the bird, Tomington said.
The white-bellied black cat weighed almost as much as Patricia. He bared his teeth and hissed in Patricia's ear as he scratched at her. Patricia did the only thing that came to mind. She clamped one hand over poor Derp, who was hanging on for dear life, and threw her head forward and down until she was bent double and her free hand was almost touching her toes. The cat went flying off her back, haranguing as he fell.
"Shut up and leave us alone," Patricia said. "You can talk. I never met a human who could talk before. Give me that bird."
"No," Patricia said. "I know where you live. I know your owner. If you are naughty, I will tell. I will tell on you." She was kind of fibbing. She didn't know who owned Tomington, but her mother might, and if Patricia came home covered with bites and scratches, her mother would be mad. At her, but also at Tomington's owner. You didn't want Patricia's mom mad at you, because she got mad for a living, and was really good at it. Tomington had landed on his toes, his fur all spiked and his ears like arrowheads.
Give me that bird, he shrieked.
No, Patricia said.
Bad cat.
She threw a rock at Tomington. He yowled. She threw another rock. He ran away.
Come on, Patricia said to Derp, who didn't have much choice in the matter. Let's get out of here. We can't let that cat know where the Parliament is, Derp whispered. If he follows us, he could find the tree. That would be a disaster. We should wander in circles, as though we are lost.
We are lost, Patricia said.
I have a pretty reasonably shrewd idea of where we go from here, said Derp. At least, a sort of a notion.
Something rustled in the low bushes just beyond the biggest tree, and for a second the moonlight glinted off a pair of eyes, framed by white fur and a collar tag.
We are finished,
Derp whispered in a pitiful warble.
That cat can stalk us forever. You might as well give me to your sister. There's nothing to be done.
Wait a minute. Patricia was remembering something about cats and trees. She had seen it in a picture book. Hang on tight, Bird. You hang on tight, okay? Derp's only response was to cling harder than ever to Patricia's overalls. Patricia looked at a few trees until she found one with sturdy enough branches and climbed. She was more tired than the first time, and her feet slipped a couple of times. One time she pulled herself up to the next branch with both hands and then looked at her shoulder and didn't see Derp. She lost her breath until she saw his head poke up nervously to look over her shoulder, and she realized he'd just been clinging to the strap farther down on her back. At last, they were on top of the tree, which swayed a little in the wind. Tommington wasn't following them. Patricia looked around twice in all directions before she saw a round fur shape scampering on the ground nearby.
"Stupid cat!" she shouted. "Stupid cat, you can't get us!" "The first person I ever met who could talk," Tommington yowled. "And you think I'm stupid? Craw! Taste my claws!"
The cat, who'd probably had lots of practice climbing one of those carpeted perches at home, ran up the side of the tree, pounced on one branch, and then a higher branch. Before Patricia and Derp even knew what was going on, the cat was halfway up.
"We're trapped! What were you thinking?"
Derp sang out. Patricia waited until Tommington had reached the top, then swung down the other side of the tree, dropping from branch to branch so fast she almost pulled her arm out, and then landed on the ground on her butt with an oof.
"Hey!"
Tommington said from the top of the tree, where his big eyes caught the moonlight.
"Where did you go? Come back here." "You are a mean cat," Patricia said. "You are a bully, and I'm going to leave you up there. You should think about what you've been doing. It's not nice to be mean. I will make sure someone comes and gets you tomorrow, but you can stay up there for now. I have to go do something. Goodbye."
"Wait,"
Tommington said.
"I can't stay up here. It's too high. I'm scared. Come back."
Patricia didn't look back. She heard Tommington yelling for a long time until they crossed a big line of trees. They got lost twice more, and at one point Derp began weeping into his good wing before they stumbled across the track that led to the secret tree. And from there, it was just a steep, back-breaking climb up a slope studded with hidden roots. Patricia saw the top of the parliamentary tree first, and then it seemed to grow out of the landscape, becoming taller and more overwhelming as she approached. The tree was sort of bird-shaped, as Derp had said, but instead of feathers, it had dark, spiky branches with fronds that hung to the ground. It loomed like the biggest church in the world, or a castle. Patricia had never seen a castle, but she guessed they would rise over you like that. 100 pairs of wings fluttered at their arrival and then stopped. A huge collection of shapes shrank into the tree.
"It's okay," Derp called out. "She's with me. I hurt my wing. She brought me here to get help."
The only response, for a long time, was silence. Then an eagle raised itself up, from near the top of the tree, a white-headed bird with a hooked beak and pale, probing eyes.
"You should not have brought her here," the eagle said.
"I'm sorry, ma'am," Derp said, "but it's okay. She can talk. She can actually talk."
Derp pivoted to speak into Patricia's ear.
"Show them. Show them."
Hi, Patricia said. "I'm sorry if we bothered you, but we need your help."
At the sound of a human talking, all of the birds went into a huge frenzy of squawking and shouting until a big owl near the eagle banged a rock against the branch and shouted,
"Order! Order!"
The eagle leaned her white fluffy head forward and studied Patricia.
"So you're to be the new witch in our forest, are you?"
"I'm not a witch," Patricia chewed her thumb. "I'm a princess."
"You had better be a witch."
The eagle's great dark body shifted on the branch.
"Because if you're not, then Derp has broken the law by bringing you to us, and he'll need to be punished. We certainly won't help fix his wing, in that case."
"Oh," Patricia said, "then I'm a witch, I guess."
"Ah." The eagle's hooked beak clicked. "But you will have to prove it, or both you and Derp will be punished."
Patricia didn't like the sound of that. Various other birds piped up, saying,
"Point of order!"
And a fidgety crow was listing important areas of parliamentary procedure. One of them was so insistent that the eagle was forced to yield the branch to the honorable gentleman from Wide Oak, who then forgot what he was going to say.
"So how do I prove that I'm a witch?"
Patricia wondered if she could run away. Birds flew pretty fast, right? She probably couldn't get away from a whole lot of birds if they were mad at her, especially magical birds.
"Well,"
a giant turkey in one of the lower branches, with wattles that looked a bit like a judge's collar, pulled himself upright and appeared to consult some markings scratched into the side of the tree before turning and giving a loud, learned "glurp" sound.
"Well," he said again, "there are several methods that are recognized in the literature. Some of them are trials of death, but we might skip those for the moment, perhaps. There are also some rituals, but you need to be of a certain age to do those. Oh, yes, here's a good one. We could ask her the endless question."
"Ooh, the endless question," a grouse said. "That's exciting."
"I haven't heard anyone answer the endless question before," said a goshawk. "This is more fun than question time."
Said Patricia, "is the endless question going to take a long time? Because I bet my mom and dad are worried about me."
It was hitting her all over again that she was up way past her bedtime and she hadn't had dinner and she was out in the middle of the freezing woods. Not to mention, she was still lost.
"Too late," the grouse said. "We're asking it," said the eagle. "Here is the question," said the turkey. "Is a tree red?"
Patricia said. "Can you give me a hint? Is that red like the color?"
The birds didn't answer.
"Can you give me more time? I promise I'll answer. I just need more time to think. Please? I need more time. Please?"
The next thing Patricia knew, her father scooped her up in his arms. He was wearing his sandpaper shirt, and his red beard was in her face, and he kept half-dropping her because he was trying to draw complicated valuation formulas with his hands while carrying her. But it was still so warm and perfect to be carried home by her daddy that Patricia didn't care.
I found her right on the outskirts of the woods near the house,
her father told her mother.
She must have gotten lost and found her own way out. It's a miracle she's okay.
You nearly scared us to death. We've been searching, along with all of the neighbors. I swear you must think my time is worthless. You've made me blow a deadline for a management productivity analysis.
Patricia's mother had her dark hair pulled back, which made her chin and nose look pointier. Her bony shoulders hunched, almost up to her antique earrings.
I just want to understand what this is about,
Patricia's father said.
What did we do that made you want to act out in this way?
Roderick Delphine was a real estate genius who often worked from home and looked after the girls when they were between nannies, sitting in a high chair at the breakfast bar with his wide face buried in equations. Patricia herself was pretty good at math, except when she thought too much about the wrong things, like the fact that the number 3 looked like an 8 cut in half. So 2 3s really ought to be 8.
She's testing us, Patricia's mother said. She's testing our authority, because we've gone too easy on her.
Belinda Delphine had been a gymnast, and her own parents had put several oceans' worth of pressure on her to excel at that. But she'd never understood why gymnastics needed to have judges, instead of measuring everything using cameras and maybe lasers. She'd met Roderick after he started coming to all her meets, and they'd invented a totally objective gymnastics measuring system that nobody had ever adopted.
"Look at her! She's just laughing at us!" Patricia's mother said, as if Patricia herself weren't standing right there. "We need to show her we mean business."
Patricia hadn't thought she was laughing at all, but now she was terrified she looked that way. She tried extra hard to fix a serious expression on her face.
"I would never run away like that," said Roberta, who was supposed to be leaving the three of them alone in the kitchen, but had come in to get a glass of water and gloat.
They locked Patricia in her room for a week, sliding food under her door. The bottom of the door tended to scrape off the top layer of whatever type of food it was. Like if it was a sandwich, the topmost piece of bread was taken away by the door. You don't really want to eat a sandwich after your door has had the first bite, but if you get hungry enough, you will.
"Think about what you've done," the parents said.
"I get all her desserts for the next 7 years," Roberta said.
"No, you don't," said Patricia. The whole experience with the Parliament of Birds became a sort of blur to Patricia. She remembered it mostly in dreams and fragments. Once or twice in school, she had a flashback of a bird asking her something, but she couldn't quite remember what the question had been or whether she'd answered it. She had lost the ability to understand the speech of animals while she was locked in her bedroom.
Chapter 2. He hated to be called Larry. Couldn't stand it. And so, of course, everybody called him Larry. Even his parents, sometimes.
"My name is Lawrence," he would insist, looking at the floor. "With a U, not a W."
Lawrence knew who he was and what he was about, but the world refused to recognize. At school, the other kids called him Larry Barry, or Larry Fairy, or, when he got mad, Scary Larry. Except that this was a rare display of irony among his troglodyte classmates, since, in fact, Larry wasn't scary at all. Usually, this was preceded by an "Ooh!" just to drive the joke home. Not that Lawrence wanted to be scary. He just wanted to be left alone, and maybe have people get his name right if they had to talk to him. Lawrence was a small kid for his age, with hair the color of late autumn leaves, a long chin, and arms like snail necks. His parents bought him clothes, 1.5 sizes too big, because they kept thinking he would hit a growth spurt any day, and they were trying to save money. so he was forever tripping over his too long, too baggy jeans legs, his hands vanishing inside his jersey sleeves. Even if Lawrence had wanted to present an intimidating figure, his lack of visible hands and feet would have made it difficult. The only bright spots in Lawrence's life were ultra-violent PlayStation games, in which he vaporized thousands of imaginary opponents. But then Lawrence found other games on the Internet, puzzles that took him hours to figure out, and MMOs, where Lawrence waged intricate campaigns. Before long, Lawrence was writing his own code. Lawrence's dad had been pretty great with computers, once. But then he'd grown up and gotten a job in the insurance industry, where he still needed a head for numbers, but it wasn't anything you'd want to hear about. Now he was always freaking out that he was going to lose his job and then they would all starve. Lawrence's mom had been working on a PhD in biology before she'd gotten pregnant and her thesis advisor had quit, and then she'd taken some time off and never quite gone back to school. Both parents worried endlessly about Lawrence spending every waking minute in front of a computer and turning out socially dysfunctional, like his Uncle Davis. So they forced Lawrence to take an endless succession of classes designed to make him get out of the house. Judo, modern dance, fencing, water polo for beginners, swimming, improv comedy, boxing, skydiving, and, worst of all, wilderness survival weekends. Each class only forced Lawrence to wear another baggy uniform while the kids shouted, "Larry, Larry, quite contrary," and held him underwater and threw him out of the airplane early and forced him to do improv while holding him upside down by his ankles. Lawrence wondered if there was some other kid named Larry who would have a let's-go attitude about being dropped on a mountainside somewhere. Larry might be the alternate universe version of Lawrence, and maybe all Lawrence needed to do was harness all the solar energy that hit the Earth during a period of 5 minutes or so, and he could generate a localized space-time fissure in his bathtub and go kidnap Larry from the other universe. So Larry could go out and get tormented instead, while Lawrence stayed home. The hard part would be figuring out a way to poke a hole in the universe before the judo tournament in 2 weeks' time. "Hey, Larry Fairy," Brad Chomner said at school, "think fast." Which was one of those phrases that never made sense to Lawrence. People who told you to think fast were always those who thought much more slowly than you did. And they only said it when they were about to do something to contribute to the collective mental inertia. And yet Lawrence had never come up with a perfect comeback to think fast, and he wouldn't have time to say whatever it was, since something unpleasant usually hit him a second later. Lawrence had to go clean himself up. One day, Lawrence found some schematics on the Internet, which he printed out and reread 100 times before he started figuring out what they meant. And once he combined them with a solar battery design that he found buried in an old message board post, he started to have something. He stole his dad's old waterproof wristwatch and combined it with some parts he scavenged from a bunch of microwave ovens and cell phones, and a few odds and ends from the electronics store. At the end of all this, he had a working time machine that fit on his wrist. The device was simple. There was just one small button. Any time you pressed the button, you would jump forward in time 2 seconds. That was all it could do. There was no way to extend the range or go backwards. Lawrence tried filming himself with his webcam and found that when he pressed the button, he did sort of disappear for an eye blink or two. But you could only use it once in a while, or you got the worst head rush of your life. A few days later, Brad Chomner said, "Think fast!" And Lawrence did think fast. He hit the button on his wrist. The white blob that had been hurtling in his direction landed in front of him with a splat. Everybody looked at Lawrence, and at the soggy toilet paper roll melting into the floor tiles, and then back at Lawrence. Lawrence put his watch into sleep mode, meaning it wouldn't work for anybody else who tinkered with it. But he needn't have worried. Everybody just thought Lawrence had ducked, with superhuman reflexes. Mr. Grandison came huffing out of his classroom and asked who threw this toilet paper, and everybody said it was Lawrence. Being able to skip 2 seconds could be quite useful if you picked the right 2 seconds. Like when you're at the dinner table with your parents and your mom has just said something sarcastic about your dad being passed over for another promotion and you just know your father is about to let out a brief but lethal burst of resentment. You need godlike timing to pick the exact instant when the barb is being launched. There are 100 leading indicators. The scent of overcooked casserole, the sensation of the room's temperature dropping slightly, the ticking of the stove powering down. You can leave reality behind and reappear for the aftermath. But there were plenty of other occasions, like when Al Danes flung him off the jungle gym onto the playground sand. He dematerialized just as he landed. Or when some popular girl was about to come up and pretend to be nice to him, just so she could laugh about it to her friends as they walked away. Or just when a teacher started an especially dull rant, even shaving off 2 seconds made a difference. Nobody seemed to notice that he flickered out of being, maybe because you had to be looking right at him, and nobody ever was. If only Lawrence could have used the device more than a few times a day without the headaches. Besides, jumping forward in time just underscored the basic problem. Lawrence had nothing to look forward to. At least, that's how Lawrence felt, until he saw the picture of the sleek shape glinting in the sunlight. He stared at the tapering curves, the beautiful nose cone, and the powerful engines, and something awoke inside him. A feeling he hadn't experienced in ages. Excitement. This privately funded DIY spaceship was going up into orbit, thanks to maverick tech investor Milton Dirth and a few dozen of his maker friends and MIT students. The launch would happen in a few days, near the MIT campus, and Lawrence had to be there. He hadn't ever wanted anything the way he wanted to see this for himself. "Dad," Lawrence said. He had already gotten off to a bad start. His father was staring at his laptop, cupping his hands as though trying to protect his mustache, the ends of which seeped into the heavy lines around his mouth. Lawrence had picked a bad time to do this. Too late. He was committed. "Dad," Lawrence said again, "there's a rocket test, sort of, on Tuesday. Here's the article about it." Lawrence's dad started to brush him off, but then some half-forgotten resolution to make time for parenting kicked in. "Oh?" He kept looking back at his laptop, which had a spreadsheet on it, until he slammed it shut and gave Lawrence as much attention as he could call undivided. "Yeah, I heard about that. It's that Dirth guy, huh? Some kind of lightweight prototype, right? That could be used to land on the dark side of the moon eventually. I heard about that." Then Lawrence's dad was joking about an old band called Floyd and marijuana and ultraviolet light. "Yeah," Lawrence cut into his dad's flow before the conversation got away from him. "That's right, Milton Dirth. And I really want to go see it. This is like a once-in-a-lifetime chance. I thought maybe we could make it a father-son thing." His dad couldn't turn down a father-son thing, or it would be like admitting to being a bad father. "Oh." His dad had an embarrassed look in his deep-set eyes behind his square glasses. "You want to go? This coming Tuesday?"
"Yes."
"But, I mean, I have work. There's a project, and I have to ace this one or it's going to look bad. And I know your mother would be upset if we just took you out of school like that. Plus, I mean, you can watch it on the computer. There'll be a webcam feed or something. You know that these things are boring in person. It's a lot of standing around, and they end up delaying it half the time. You won't even see anything if you're there. You'll get a way better view via the web." Lawrence's dad sounded as though he was trying to convince himself as much as his son. Lawrence nodded. There was no point in arguing once his father had started piling on reasons, so Lawrence said nothing until he could safely back away. Then he went up to his room and looked at bus schedules. A few days later, while his parents were still asleep, Lawrence tiptoed downstairs and found his mom's purse on the little side table near the front door. He opened the clasp as if a live animal could jump out. Every noise in the house sounded too loud, the coffee maker heating up and the refrigerator buzzing. Lawrence found a leather wallet inside the purse and pulled out $50. He had never stolen before. He kept expecting police officers to burst in the front door and cuff him. The second phase of Lawrence's plan involved going face-to-face with his mom right after he'd robbed her. He caught up with her when she'd just woken up, still bleary in her marigold robe, and told her there was a school field trip and he needed her to write a note saying it was okay for him to go. He had already figured out a great universal truth that people never asked for documentation of anything as long as you asked them for documentation first. Lawrence's mom pulled out a stubby ergonomic pen and scrawled a permission slip. Her manicure was peeling. Lawrence said it might be an overnight trip, in which case he would call. She nodded, bright red curls bouncing. Walking to the bus stop, Lawrence had a nervous moment. He was going on a big trip on his own. Nobody knew where he was, and he only had $50 in his pocket, plus a fake Roman coin. What if someone jumped out from behind the dumpsters by the strip mall and attacked Lawrence? What if someone dragged him into their truck and drove him hundreds of miles before changing his name to Darryl and forcing him to live as their homeschooled son? Lawrence had seen a TV movie about this. But then Lawrence remembered the wilderness weekends and the fact that he'd found fresh water and edible roots and even scared off this one chipmunk that had seemed intent on fighting him for the trail mix. He'd hated every second, but if he could survive that, then he could handle taking a bus into Cambridge and figuring out how to get to the launch site. He was Lawrence of Ellenburg, and he was unflappable. Lawrence had just figured out that unflappable didn't have anything to do with whether people could mess up your clothing, and now he used that word as much as he could. "I am unflappable," Lawrence told the bus driver, who shrugged, as if he'd thought so too, once upon a time, until someone had flapped him. Lawrence had packed a bunch of supplies, but he'd only brought one book, a slender paperback about the last great interplanetary war. Lawrence finished that book in an hour, and then he had nothing to do but stare out the window. The trees along the highway seemed to slow down as the bus passed alongside them, then sped up again. A kind of time dilation. The bus arrived in Boston, and then Lawrence had to find the T station. He walked into Chinatown, where there were people selling stuff on the street and restaurants with enormous fish tanks in their windows, as though the fish wanted to inspect potential customers before they would be allowed in. And then Lawrence was crossing the water, and the Museum of Science was gleaming in the morning sun, opening its steel and glass arms to him and brandishing its planetarium. It wasn't until Lawrence reached the MIT campus and he was standing in front of the Legal Seafoods, trying to make sense of the map of coded buildings, that he realized he had no idea how to find where this rocket launch was happening. Lawrence had imagined he would arrive at MIT and it would look like a bigger version of Murchison Elementary School, with front steps and a bulletin board where people posted upcoming activities. Lawrence couldn't even get into the first couple buildings he tried. He did find a board where people had posted notices for lectures and dating advice and the Ig Nobel Awards, but no mention of how to watch the big launch. Lawrence ended up in Au Bon Pain, eating a corn muffin and feeling like a dope. If he could get on the Internet, maybe he could figure out what to do next. But his parents wouldn't let him have a phone yet, much less a laptop. The cafe was playing mournful oldies, Janet Jackson saying she got so lonely, Britney Spears confessing she did it again. He cooled each sip of hot chocolate with a long breath while he tried to strategize. Lawrence's book was gone, the one he'd been reading on the bus. He had put it on the table near his muffin, and now it was gone. No, wait. It was in the hands of a woman in her 20s, with long brown braids, a wide face, and a red sweater that was so fuzzy it practically had hair. She had calloused hands and work boots. She was turning Lawrence's book over and over in her hands. "Sorry," she said. "I remember this book. I read it like 3 times in high school. This is the one with the binary star system that goes to war with the AIs who live in the asteroid belt, right?"
Yeah," Lawrence said.
"Good choice." Now she was checking out Lawrence's wrist. "Hey, that's a 2-second time machine, isn't it?"
Yeah," Lawrence said.
"Cool. I have one, too."
She showed him. It looked about the same as Lawrence's, except it was a little smaller, and it had a calculator.
"It took me ages to figure out those diagrams online. It's like a little test of engineering skill and moxie and stuff, and in the end you get a little device with 1,000 uses. Mind if I sit down? I'm standing over you, and it makes me feel like an authority figure."
Lawrence said that was okay. He was having a hard time contributing to this conversation. The woman sat in front of him and the remains of his muffin. Now that he was at eye level with her, she was sort of pretty. She had a cute nose and round chin. She reminded him of a social studies teacher he'd had a crush on last year.
"I'm Isabel," said the woman. "I'm a rocket scientist."
It turned out she'd shown up for the big rocket launch, but it was delayed because of some last-minute problems and weather and stuff.
"It'll probably be in a few days. You know how these things go."
"Oh." Lawrence looked into his hot chocolate foam. So that was it. He wasn't going to get to see anything. Somehow he'd let himself believe that if he saw a rocket blast off, something that had been right in front of him and was now free of our planet's gravity, he would be set free, too. He could go back to school and it wouldn't matter because he'd been connected to something that was in outer space. Now he was just going to be the freak who ditched school for nothing. He looked at the cover of the paperback, which had a painting of a lumpy spaceship and a naked woman with eyes for breasts. He didn't start to cry or anything, but he kind of wanted to. The paperback cover said, "They went to the ends of the universe to stop a galactic disaster."
"Drat,"
Lawrence said. "Thanks for letting me know."
"No problem," Isabel said. She told him more about the rocket launch and just how revolutionary this new design was, stuff he already knew, and then she noticed he was looking miserable.
"Hey, don't worry. It's just delayed a few days."
"Yeah, but," Lawrence said, "I won't be able to be here then."
"Oh."
"I will be otherwise occupied. I have a prior engagement."
Lawrence stammered a little. He kneaded the edge of the table so the skin on his hot chocolate grew ridges.
"You must be a busy man," Isabel said. "It sounds as though you have a packed schedule."
"Actually," Lawrence said, "every day is the same as every other day, except for today."
And now he did start to cry. God damn it.
"Hey." Isabel abandoned her chair opposite him and came to sit next to him.
"Hey, hey. It's okay. Listen. Do your parents know where you are?"
"Not," Lawrence sniffled, "not as such."
He wound up telling her the whole deal, how he'd stolen $50 from his mom, how he'd ditched school and taken the bus and the tea. As he told Isabel, he started to feel bad for making his parents worry, but also he knew with increasing certainty that this stunt wouldn't be repeatable. Not a few days from now, at any rate.
Okay, Isabel said. Wow. Well, I guess I ought to call your parents. It'll take them a while to get here, though, especially with the confusing directions I'm going to give them for getting to the launch site. Launch site? But since that's where you're going to be by the time they arrive. She patted Lawrence's shoulder. He had stopped crying, thank God, and was pulling himself back into shape. Come on, I'm going to show you the rocket. I'll give you the tour and introduce you to some of the people. She stood up and offered Lawrence her hand. He took it. And that was how Lawrence got to meet a dozen or so of the coolest rocket nerds on Earth. Isabel drove him there in her tobacco-scented red Mustang, and Lawrence's feet were buried under Frito bags. Lawrence heard MC Frontalot for the first time on her car stereo. Have you ever read Heinlein? Maybe a little grown up, but I bet you could handle his juveniles. Here. She dug around in the back seat and handed him a battered paperback called Have Spacesuit, Will Travel, which had a pleasingly lurid cover. She said he could keep it. She had another copy. They drove along Memorial Drive and then through an endless series of identical highways and switchbacks and tunnels, and Lawrence realized Isabel was right. His parents would get lost several times trying to come pick him up, even if she gave them perfect, non-confusing directions. They always complained that driving in Boston was asking for it. The afternoon grew duller as clouds set in, but Lawrence didn't care. Behold, Isabel said, a single-stage, Earth-to-orbit rocket. I drove all the way from Virginia just to help with this. My boyfriend is crazy jealous. It was two or three times Lawrence's size, housed in a barn near the water. It glimmered, its pale metal shell catching the streaks of light through the barn windows. Isabel walked Lawrence around it, showing him all the cool features, including the carbon nanofiber insulation around the fuel systems and the lightweight silicate organic polymer casing on the actual engines. Lawrence reached out and touched the rocket, feeling the dimpled skin with his fingertips. People started wandering up, demanding to know who this kid was and why he was touching their precious rocket. "That's delicate equipment." The tight-lipped man in a turtleneck sweater folded his arms. "We can't have just random kids running around our rocket barn," a small woman in overalls said. "Lawrence," Isabel said, "show them." He knew what she meant. He reached down to his right wrist with his left hand and pressed the little button. He felt the familiar sensation, like a skipped heartbeat or a double breath that lasted no time at all. And then it was 2 seconds later, and he was still standing next to a beautiful rocket in a ring of people who were all staring at him. Everybody clapped. Lawrence noticed they were all wearing things on their wrists, too, like this was a trend or a badge. After that, they treated him like one of them. He had conquered a small piece of time, and they were conquering a small piece of space. They understood, as he did, that this was a down payment. One day, they would own a much bigger share of the cosmos, or their descendants would. You celebrated the small victories, and you dreamed of the big ones to come. "Hey, kid," one hairy guy in jeans and sandals said, "check out what I did with this thruster design. It's pretty sweet." "What we did," Isabel corrected him. Turtleneck guy was older, in his 30s or 40s, maybe even 50s, with thinning salt-and-pepper hair and big eyebrows. He kept asking Lawrence questions and making notes on his phone. He asked Lawrence to spell his name, twice. "Remind me to look you up on your 18th birthday, kid," he said. Someone brought Lawrence a soda and pizza. By the time Lawrence's parents arrived, boiling in their own skins after having to figure out the turnpike and Starro Drive and the tunnels and everything, Lawrence had become the mascot of the single-stage orbital rocket gang. On the long drive home, Lawrence tuned out his parents explaining to him that life isn't an adventure, for Christ's sake. Life is a long slog and a series of responsibilities and demands. When Lawrence was old enough to do what he liked, he would be old enough to understand he couldn't do what he liked. The sun went down. The family stopped for burgers and more lecturing. Lawrence kept sneaking looks under the table at his propped-open copy of Have Spacesuit, Will Travel. He was already halfway through the book. Book 2 Chapter 3 The classrooms on the western side of Canterbury Academy's pale cement mausoleum had windows facing the parking lot, the sports field, and the two-lane highway. But the east windows looked down a muddy slope to a stream, beyond which an uneven fringe of trees shivered in the September wind. In the school's stale marshmallow-scented air, Patricia could look east and imagine running wild. The first week of school, Patricia smuggled an oak leaf in her skirt pocket, the nearest thing she had to a talisman, which she touched until it broke into crumbs. All through math and English, her two classes with views of the east, she watched the stub of forest, and wished she could escape there and go fulfill her destiny as a witch, instead of sitting and memorizing old speeches by Rutherford B. Hayes. Her skin crawled under her brand-new training bra, stiff sweater, and school jumper, while around her kids texted and chattered, "Is Casey Hamilton going to ask Tracy Burt out? Who tried what over the summer?" Patricia rocked her chair up and down, until it struck the floor with a clang that startled everyone at her group table. 7 years had passed since some birds had told Patricia she was special. Since then, she'd tried every spell book and every mystical practice on the Internet. She'd misplaced herself in the woods over and over until she knew by heart every way to get lost. She carried a first aid kit in case she met any more injured creatures. But no wild things ever spoke, and nothing magical ever happened. As if the whole thing had been some kind of prank, or she'd failed a test without knowing. Patricia walked through the playground after lunch with her face upcast, trying to keep pace with an unkindness of ravens passing over the school. The ravens gossiped among themselves, without letting Patricia in on their conversation, just like the kids at this school. Not that Patricia cared. She'd tried to make friends, because she'd promised her mom. And witches kept their promises, she guessed. But she was joining this school in the eighth grade, after everyone else had been here a couple years. Just yesterday, she'd stood at the girls' room sink next to Macy Firestone and her friends, as Macy obsessed about Brent Harper blowing her off at lunch. Macy's bright lip gloss perfectly set off her creamsicle hair dye. Patricia, coating her hands with oily green fake soap, had been seized by a conviction that she, too, ought to say something funny and supportive about the appeal, and yet the tragic insufficiency of Brent Harper, who had twinkly eyes and moosed-up hair. So she'd stammered that Brent Harper was the worst, and at once she had girls on both sides of her, demanding to know exactly what her problem was with Brent Harper. What had Brent ever done to her? Carrie Danning spat so hard, her perfect blonde hair almost lost a barrette. The ravens flew in no formation Patricia could discern, even though most of the school's lessons, this first week, had been about finding patterns in everything. Patterns were how you answered standardized test questions, how you committed large blocks of text to memory, and ultimately how you created structure in your life. This was the famous Cyrenian program. But Patricia looked at the ravens, loquacious in their hurry to go nowhere, and could find no sense to any of it. They retraced their path, as if they were going to notice Patricia after all, then looped back toward the road. What was the point of telling Patricia she was a witch and then leaving her alone? For years.